So that was our path analysis. And now we move to the contributory factor analysis. So the path analysis was a kind of structural regression model where you only have observed variables. And contributory factor analysis adds latent variables. So we have variables that don't have case values. We just don't have data for them. And they're unobserved variables. And then we have indicators for those unobserved variables. And these models are closely related to the exploratory factor analysis techniques that we discussed a month ago. To understand why we specify confirmatory factor analysis models in a certain way, we need to review a bit of what is measurement. So what does the term measurement mean, or the act of measuring something? Well, measurement means that we have some kind of quantity and we assign it a number. We have a person who is smart and we have a person who is a bit less smart. We want to assign a number to the intelligence of a person. We have organization that is highly successful in developing customer information systems, and we have an organization that is less successful in developing customer information systems. We want to assign numbers to the capabilities of those organizations. So measurement is about numbers. And what's tricky is that often the things that we make theories about are not directly quantifiable. So we can't say that the information system, the open capability of one organization is 5 and another organization is 3. So we have to come up with a way of quantifying things that don't have natural quantities. Why do we use multiple questions? Oftentimes we do a measurement with survey. We want to know how companies develop information systems. We send them a survey. Why do we ask multiple questions?
Are we going to spot that people are answering the survey seriously? And if you ask 3 times the same question and you have a different answer in each of them, you should discard this data. Somebody was answering.
Yeah, that's one. So the reason why we are asking the same thing over and over in a slightly different format is to triangulate. So we want to know, in this example from ISR, we have a measure, we want to measure accuracy and completeness of information in government information systems. And we ask the users 6 questions. We ask 3 questions about accuracy. They are supposed to be independent measures of accuracy. Then we can, if we work with regression analysis, we can take a mean of those 3 items or a sum and then apply that in a regression analysis. Then we can also, like you said, we can compare the items. If the items on an individual level don't correlate, if they look like random noise, we can just throw that individual out from our data. And also we can check if 2 items correlate, and if they're supposed to measure the same thing, and if they correlate highly, then we can conclude that maybe they measure the same thing, maybe they're reliable. So this paper explains that the average response is the real grid scores, and that's the way most people start with. So you measure 3 indicators, you take a sum of those indicators, you put that to a regression analysis, and that's an easy way of analyzing. Then you can do Cronbach's alpha and composite reliability, which basically look at how much the items in a scale are correlated. If they're highly correlated, then we say that the scale is reliable. And if they're not highly correlated, then we say that the scale is unreliable. And then we make conclusions based on that. So reliability and validity in quantitative research are, they can be thought of as a hierarchy. And first we have reliability, which basically means that if we measure the same thing over and over and over, do we get the same result? So reliability is about the presence of random error in the results. And because our computers that do our analysis are completely deterministic, and because we are good researchers, we document our procedures so well that we can replicate them 5 years later, there is no researcher-related uncertainty. So how many of you always save your data files or save your analysis files when you do a statistical analysis? How many of you try to publish your analysis files in an appendix to your paper? I do. So we want to eliminate the researcher uncertainty. And only thing that is related to random error is the data. And that actually brings me to a point. I wanted to write a response to a paper published in MIS Quarterly. And the authors use a nonsensical modeling. And I sent the authors, for one, their degrees of freedom reported in the paper doesn't match the number of variables in the paper. It's off by 500 or so. So they're doing something that they are not reporting. And I asked them to get their analysis files. And they said, well, we don't have them. Then I asked her, could I have the log files from the analysis? Then they said, we don't have them either. We just copy-pasted the results to Word and closed our statistical software. I was like, great. So we have a result that no one really knows how it was done. So it's important that you make your research in a way that you can actually reproduce it yourself. Because if someone questions it, then you can say, that's what I did. And it's going to be really embarrassing if someone says that we wanted to know how these guys did their research, but they couldn't explain. So you don't want to be caught up with that. Okay, that was a detour. Then we have measurement validity, whether the indicators or the data actually measures what they're supposed to measure. And then we have these other kinds of validity. But these two are the most important parts about measurement. And this is a review from the last time. And measurement reliability and measurement validity are like precision and accuracy. So we have very precise here. So this is reliable. We always get the same result, but it is invalid because the result is incorrect. So we could measure a person's intelligence by measuring the circumference of her head, and we would get always then nearly the same result depending on how long the long hair the person had at the time of measurement. But it's an invalid because it doesn't really correlate with your intelligence. We could also have highly reliable and unreliable data that are bad. So we have, my favorite example is weighting of a wiggling child. So with this child on a scale, you get 9 kilos, you put her on a scale again, you get 11 kilos because the child wiggles. So you get a random noise in that measurement. But on average, it's going to be correct. So if you measure the child 5 times, you take a mean of those measurements, you can be close to the bullseye. So that's the difference between reliability and validity. Then in the last time, we talked about the concept of reliability, where it comes from. And it comes from classical test theory. So this is developed by psychologists in the 1970s. Reliability is defined using this kind of equation. So we have x is the actual measured value, t is true score. What the true score is not relevant, and then e is random noise. So the idea is that reliability is the degree to which this observed score is random noise. And it can be defined as the squared correlation between the measured score and the true score, or 1 minus variance of the error score, and so on. So the reliability based on classical test theory answers the question, if we repeat the measure over and over and over again, and the measures are highly correlated, the repeated measures, then we get reliability. So that's what it gives us. Reliability here is defined as parallel experiments. So this is a classical example is that we ask Mr. Brown, a person, whether he likes United Nations or not. Then we brainwash the person and we repeat the study, the question again. So we repeat the same question again and again and again as an independent replication. Then if those answers are correlated, then it's going to be reliable. If they are not correlated, then it's unreliable. So, of course, we can't do really independent repeated measures, because if I ask you whether you like United Nations, do you like United Nations?
Why not?
Yeah, when I ask you the same question again, do you like United Nations?
Yeah, I try to be.
Yeah, you're going to be asking the same question because you want to be. It would be really weird to say I like United States, United Nations, and the next second say that you don't like United Nations. Maybe there is some uncertainty in whether you like it or not, but if you're being asked the same question repeatedly, you're going to be asked with the same answer because it feels weird not to do so. So we really need the brainwashing here. We need to brainwash the person so that they don't remember that we actually asked them. And that's a counterfactual argument because we can brainwash people when you do research. Or even if we could, that would be pretty unethical. So what kind of workarounds we do? We can't ask the same question over and over again at the exact same time point from the exact same person. So what do we do? What kind of workarounds we do?
At different points in time.
Yeah, we could ask the same question at different points of time. I could ask you whether you like United Nations now, and I could ask you the same question a week later. Maybe a week later you don't remember what I was asking you anymore. That's one. So we actually do replications with a time difference. What else?
We ask different people.
No, we are measuring one person.
Slightly different questions.
Yeah, we ask slightly different questions. Do you like United Nations? Do you like the idea that nations come together to discuss world problems rather than have wars? Things like that. So we have the workarounds are that we do actual replications, but we have the time delay, or that we assume that distinct measures are actually parallel. Which one do we do more? Yeah, second one, because the first one is actually if we do survey, we would have to send the survey multiple times, get the same set of people to answer multiple times, and that's a lot more difficult than just having two questions in the survey. So the second one is common, so we do distinct tests. So the idea is that we test things, we ask questions, if they correlate, then they may be reliable. Okay, so that's a little bit of a measurement theory. And then, what is the effect of unreliability in the data? If we have variables X and Y here measured perfectly, and they're correlated at 0.5 in the population, we have a sample size of 300, and we have an observed correlation of 0.5 or 2. So it's pretty close to the correct population value. What happens if we add unreliability in the form of random noise to X and Y?
We will underestimate.
Yeah. When we add noise to our signal, then it means that we will not detect effects as easily, and those effects that we detect will be underestimated. So the effect of random measurement error or unreliability is that we're going to be underestimating the effect. That's important if you think that reliability of 0.7 is okay, Cronbach's alpha 0.7, yeah. How many of you think that's okay? Yeah, so you have Cronbach's alpha 0.7 of your independent variable and your dependent variable. It means that your effects are going to be underestimated by -50%. So, unreliability of the data is a big problem, and people don't realize how much they are underestimating their effects. Of course, if you have multiple regression model, then the effects can also go up if there's measurement error, and it's very difficult to say how measurement error becomes. So, when we have random measurement error, then we're going to be underestimating here by about 50% actual correlation. So, we can seriously bias this. Then we could reduce measurement error by taking, asking the same question over and over again, as I said. And the idea is that even if these are individually off target, they are on average correct. So we can take, the typical way of doing that is just to take a sum. So we do these composite measures. I'm just going through quickly because that's what we talked about last time. And when you create composite measures, it's very important that those indicators actually measure the one thing and one thing only. So sometimes you see that we say that we measure three different dimensions of information systems development project success. So we measure on time, on budget, and with all features were delivered that were supposed to be delivered. Then we take a sum of those three indicators, and that's our composite.
How can you be sure that two of those measure exactly the same thing?
Well, you can never be sure.
But
if they have been developed using a rigorous scale development procedure, and if your factor analysis fits well, then you could be confident. Otherwise, no. Aggregating things that are not unidimensional makes as much sense as summing person's size and weight, height and weight, and use that as a variable of calling person size. So my size is about 250. So what does it really tell about me? It doesn't help you buy me clothes. It doesn't tell you me whether I should eat more or less, because I could be a tall and skinny person and short and fat person have the same value. So you have to establish that your indicators measure the same thing. And to do that, we apply factor analysis. So briefly about validity before we go to factor analysis. The idea of measurement validity. So what does it, if we say that we have intelligence of a person, and then we have an intelligence test question. What does it mean that the intelligence test question measures intelligence?
Intelligent people should be able to answer it.
Yeah. If we have a question, then smart people should answer the question correctly, and less smart people are less likely to answer the question correctly. So that's the idea of if it's a valid measure. If the measured score doesn't depend on person's actual intelligence, then it wouldn't be a valid measure, right? So we are saying that people vary in their intelligence, and whether they answer the intelligence test question correctly also varies. And the variation in the question depends on the variation in the attribute being measured. Idea being that those people who are smarter are more likely to answer the question correctly than those people who are less smart. And that's the definition of validity. So the idea is that a test or a measure can be valid if the thing that we want to measure exists and the variation in the thing being measured causally produces variation in the actual measure. So it's a very simple concept, the validity, but then demonstrating validity is pretty difficult. So I'm going to skip a couple of slides. So how we do validation, validity and reliability assessment is that we apply this kind of model. So we're saying that we have a trait, T, that we measure. Then we have multiple indicators. And we say that these indicators here depend on the thing that we measure, because by definition of validity we have indicators depending on the thing that we measure. Then we have some random noise here, so these error terms are random noise, and then we estimate how much each of these indicators correlate with the thing being measured. And that's the factor analysis model. So we talked about exploratory factor analysis. I'm skipping a couple of things again now. So factor analysis gives us this kind of results, exploratory factor analysis. This is from Information Systems Research article sometime last fall, I think. So we have this kind of analysis result from a factor analysis. This is from an exploratory factor analysis. We have all the indicators here. We have these accuracy items. They're supposed to measure one thing. we have need for government services items are supposed to measure another thing. Then we apply factor analysis. And factor analysis answers the question of what do these items have in common. But before we go into the factor analysis, let's briefly ask, what does this table tell us? How many of you know how to interpret this kind of factor analysis table?
Well, we should know, right?
We're supposed to know.
Yes. You're supposed to know, and even if you don't take this course, you're supposed to know, because our factor analysis table is pretty easy to interpret. So we have...
What I see is there are some factors, factor 1, 2, 3, up to 11.
Yeah.
And then, for instance, the accuracy items load on factor 1, and it's only the accuracy items that load on that factor. Then on factor 2, need for governance, and they are the only items that load on that factor.
Yeah.
But what do those numbers mean? Because I didn't, I went to the course and whatever, and I cannot remember.
Okay, yeah. So the factors here represent the things that we want to measure. And factor loadings are estimates of how much each indicator correlate with the thing that it's supposed to measure.
Okay.
Yeah. So if we have a 0.93 correlation here,
that's the best.
Accuracy 2 item is estimated to be highly reliable. So these factor loadings here, these are marked in bold. So always the highest is marked as bold, or that's typically the case in this table. So these individual indicators tell something about the reliability of these numbers.
So if you will want to select the best one over there, you will go for accuracy too?
No, you take a sum of all the indicators. I don't recommend that you report, you drop items unless you have a good theoretical reason to do so. Never, you don't modify your model or drop things based on empirical reasons.
Just a sum like that, not 0.75.
No, you just take a sum. So doing weights doesn't really do you any good, and it can mess you up. So we'll talk about that a bit tomorrow.
Right.
And so the factor analysis tells us which of these items go together, so to say. So if these three items correlate highly, then it means that they may measure the same thing. And so every item should load on one factor and one factor only highly, and these other correlations should be small. So the idea is that when we have an indicator that loads highly, then after controlling for this factor, it should be uncorrelated with all other factors. What does it? That's a statistical statement. And what it means is that an indicator should measure one thing and one thing only. So if we have an intelligence test, it should measure intelligence and not intelligence and your socioeconomic background. So a question about the location of, let's say, New York's jewelry stores as a part of an intelligence test. That's going to be measuring the person's socioeconomic status rather than intelligence. So we want to have things that measure one thing and one thing only. So when we have this kind of clean factor pattern matrix, so each indicator loads on one factor only and loads on other factors, that means that our measures may be valid, and we can interpret these as estimates of reliability. So we take square of that, and we get the estimate of reliability for that item. So factor analysis basically allows us to analyze dimensionality in our data.
I have just a question related to the previous slide.
Yeah.
I was just not able to interpret what is the meaning of the minus sign. So I have some values that look the same, looks all right, but in some of the diagonal lines, we have a minus sign. So minus 0.7. The values look equal, but why are they negative?
It's arbitrary. The sign is arbitrary here. So typically, we scale the factors in such a we can demonstrate that in a computer plan. So we'll do factor analysis with Excel. So you can just switch the sign yourself and see what happens. But we have a negative sign here and negative sign here, and they are all negative, and just happens to be that way. Negative and positive, it doesn't make a difference. If all are positive and one is negative, then that could happen if you have an item that is reverse coded. So you ask whether you're intelligent, whether you're smart, and then you ask the third question of whether you're stupid. So we could expect the third question to be negatively correlated with the first two because it measures your intelligence, but it does it so in a reverse code. So, but yeah, that was a good observation. I didn't really myself pay any attention, but these are arbitrary. Sometimes you get negative logins, sometimes you get all positive logins. It relates to our scale setting of latent variables. So the factor analysis seeks a smaller number of underlying factors that would explain the data, and we want to interpret those factors as being the things that we want to measure. Then answers the question of what the indicators have in common. We have two modeling approaches or analysis approaches in factor analysis. One is exploratory factor analysis, where we tell the computer that this is our data, find us 11 factors from the data. Then computer will produce you something like that. Then we have the confirmatory factor analysis, where we tell the computer that we expect these indicators to be one factor, these indicators to be another factor. Then the computer will estimate factor loadings and also provide a test of whether the factor pattern actually matches the data or not. The difficulty the difference between these two is that exploratory factor analysis is a lot easier to apply. You just need to tell computer that that's my data, give me 10 factors. In confirmatory factor analysis, we would have to assign each indicator to a factor. So we have lots more decisions to make. We have to tell the computer lots more information about the model in confirmatory analysis. So confirmatory analysis is more difficult to apply, but it's also a much more rigorous technique than exploratory factor analysis. Let's take a look at a conceptual example of a confirmatory factor analysis next. So the idea of a confirmatory factor analysis is that our indicators here, A1, A2, and A3, and B1, B2, and B3, they measure constructs A and B. So the idea is that these are valid because some variance of indicator A1 is due to the variance of the construct, and there is some random noise and some unrelated variance. The factor analysis looks at our indicators, and it takes the indicator variance apart. So it looks at these indicators first, and it looks at these circles, these variance components, and which ones of those various components could go together and which ones don't belong together. Then it splits the variances so that all variance related to the factors go to the factors and everything else goes to the error terms. The idea is that we specify that the variation of this indicator A1 is some variance related to the factor and some variance that is unrelated to the factor. And we assume that these indicators, these error terms, are also uncorrelated. So we take the variation in the indicators apart. Then the factor analysis software, or SCM software, will tell us what is the correlation between factor A and B, and it will also tell how much of the variation of indicator A1 is attributed to factor. We call that the factor loading. We use the lambda symbols. So we take it apart. We can also use confirmatory factor analysis to model problems in measurement. So let's say that we have correlated errors. So let's assume that indicators A3 and A1 have some kind of measurement error component that is correlated with both indicators. So we have this component here that is correlated, and we can say that these error terms can be correlated in a computer factor analysis model, and it allows the correlated errors to be. Why would that kind of thing make sense? And when we would have correlated measurement errors? So let's say that we are, the A would be innovativeness, and B would be productivity of a company. And our questions would be, our firm is innovative, our firm has many patents, our person is innovative, our person is productive, our products are, we produce more with less, and our firm is productive. So these two indicators could be considered as measures of a secondary dimension called personal quality or something like that. So we are saying that they are correlated not only because one measures productivity, another one measures innovativeness, and we expect those two to be correlated, but also because both measure something about the personnel of the company. So in that kind of scenarios, you may add correlated errors to a confounder factor analysis model. And this is something that you can't do an exploratory factor analysis. You could also model measurement effects. So let's say that our indicators vary because A indicators measure construct A, B indicators measure construct B, but they also all correlate because we are asking them on a 5-point scale, one after another, on one survey form, from one person at one point of time. So we have, and certain people tend to answer on the right-hand side of the 5-point scale more often than on the left-hand side, and vice versa. So we have a measurement effect. Our indicators correlate because of the measurement process. We can model that kind of things as well. So we can add a secondary factor and a confounder factor on this model. So the variance of A indicators now, they escape the error terms, A and B, and this method factor here. Yeah. So if you were at the previous course, we talked about common method variance, and this looks like a silver bullet for that kind of scenarios. But the problem is that this works in some limited scenarios, in simulations and in theory, and in practice, this kind of models are very problematic. So I'm going to skip that. So let's talk about estimation of factor models. So do you want to have a small break now? Because you look pretty tired.
Yes. Yeah.
Let's have a 5-minute, go out to class, walk around, come back.